Our primary goal in sharing our work and publishing it was the results about the current landscape and the way it's put together and what these species, what our sample says about their ecological distribution and preferences.
I'm Liza Lester. In this episode of Field Talk, National Park Service scientist Carl Roland tells me about documenting the tremendous landscape encompassed by Alaska's Denali, Wrangell St. Elias, and Yukon-Charley National Parks. Carl and his colleagues from the Inventory and Monitoring Program are embarked on continuous monitoring of all the vegetable life, from the trees to the lichen, within these three vast parks of the Alaskan interior. Their program sets a baseline to understand the forests and grasslands of the present day, and potential future transformations brought by a warming climate.
Those things certainly shed light on these questions of how things are going to change, and that's why we couched it in that way.
They have just published in the February issue of ESA's journal Ecological Monographs the first 10 years of tree data from Denali, a park that encompasses nearly 5 million acres of tundra, taiga, lowlands, and rugged mountains, including the highest peak in North America.
You know, we've already had some articles published like, oh, don't worry, you know, white spruce are going to flood the interior, which, you know, we didn't say and bugs me, but it's an inevitable sort of popularization of, because people would rather, they've heard enough scary things about what's going to happen. I think there's a tendency to want to hear good things about what's going to happen.
I spoke with Carl on February 14th, 2013. You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
How's the weather in Fairbanks this morning?
Oh, well, it's, you know, a balmy 0 degrees Fahrenheit.
Is the sun already up for you there?
Yeah, you know, this is a fantastic time of year. It's like the sun is coming back with a vengeance. We basically gain 7 minutes of daylight per day. It's hard to explain how good it is.
Well, do you do much field work in the winter there, or is it all office work at that time of year?
Yeah, I don't do much field work in the winter. I mean, there's a bunch of things that I would like to do, and I think that it's actually, especially in vegetation studies, a huge missing component, because the winter is such a big part, a crucial part of the ecology, obviously. And it's interesting because, you know, for vegetation, not much gets done. Depending on what question you're asking, more should be done. But, you know, when it's 50 below out, it's pretty hard to do anything.
So you're working in Denali National Park. What are the logistics of getting into your study sites like?
Oh, it's, you know, it's a challenge. It's 6 million acres and there's basically one road that enters the park. You know, there's a lot of places that it requires aircraft to get to the study sites. And that's been a big part of deciding on how to design our study because, you know, it's very expensive and it's also wilderness. We go to a place and we work there for 10 days and then we come out. We've used everything in my Alaska career from horseback, rafts, fixed wing aircraft, helicopters. So pretty much the cheapest way we can get into a study site and the most reasonable and safe way is the way we do it. And that certainly adds a layer of complication relative to where you can drive to your sites. It's also, you know, wonderful to be out in the wilderness, so that's not so bad. For the program that this paper came from, I've got crews in three national parks simultaneously during the summer. We rely a lot on other folks in the Park Service, you know, rangers and that, to assist us with sort of Sherpa, you know, carry it all in. While this article focuses on trees and forests, it encompasses the entire landscape. So we have plots on 40-degree scree slopes, lake shores. We have plots that actually land right in the middle of the river. And one thing that's different about the way we do things is that we really don't move a plot. We sample it where it lies. So there's pictures of us with our pants rolled up, you know, doing our transects half in a lake and half out. And you know, one could quarrel with that way of doing things. It's we decided to sort of sample the landscape as opposed to sample the vegetation. So there's no stratification. You know, the proportion of samples that enter our data set are basically how it exists on the landscape, you know?
So you have a means of randomizing in advance, and then you say, we're not going to question this when we arrive. We're going to, if it's scree, if it's in a lake, we're still going to sample there.
Yeah, so what we have, you know, we have highly accurate GPS, so we get to a spot, and then we actually, once you're within a meter, you drop a pin, and then you do a random bearing and a random aspect, and so you don't get to avoid the alder thicket that's right over there or what have you. it's a very complicated thing, you know, this nature, and we don't really want to put all our eggs in one theory of how things are going to change or another theory. We simply want to let the data that comes in over subsequent iterations inform us about what's happening. And of course, there's costs to that. So one thing that we didn't do in designing this, which is very different from most research in the strict sense, is optimize the design for one thing or another. So if you're doing research on tree line, you're going to allocate your samples in a certain manner, right? You're going to do transects that cross that gradient or something.
So you're trying to establish a solid baseline data set that could be used to look at many different hypotheses and not be just focused towards where's the tree line going?
Exactly.
You know, how are foraging patterns changing? Is that what you're saying?
So really, I mean, it's the baseline of the current landscape as it is. And it's both a strength and a weakness, I would say, of the design, is that with this design, very consciously, we wanted to, you know, capture unexpected things as well as maybe expected things. I really feel good about that decision because it's a robust data set. We're using it for everything for modeling caribou forage on a landscape scale to this article to looking at how diversity patterns change.
Traveling back a little bit to your description of the study design,
yeah.
Does this allow you, the different scales you're looking at, large landscape scale, multiple parks in interior Alaska, all the way down to the different elevations within your clustered area, does this allow you to look at different types of drivers of ecological change, or hopefully in the future to be able to look at those things?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's really, you know, if you take something like the aspect of a slope, which again, because of the sun angle in Alaska, is super important. The importance of that is going to vary geographically within the state because of the amount of cloudiness. So in cloudy areas, maritime influence climate, you know, the influence of aspect is going to be different than hard interior areas where it's sunny all the time and you get direct solar radiation. So I'm not sure if this gets to your question, but, you know, you can kind of parse driving factors, landscape factors that way, because if you have sufficient samples in these various different kinds of areas, emerging from that is an understanding of how these ecological factors vary themselves over geographic space. You know, there's going to be different fire return intervals, for example, among the different parks. And even these parks are so big that within the parks, the far western lowlands of Denali National Park, the fire return interval is very different than, say, the Tokelat Basin ecoregion. You know, even though they both primarily support black spruce woodland in more or less permafrosted terrain, the frequency with which that burns is different just based on the topography surrounding it, where the lightning strikes are. And so you know, those kind of things can also emerge from having this multi-scale design. You know, and of course, some of these things aren't going to reveal themselves for decades.
It sounds like white spruce and to some extent black spruce are kind of like an iconic tree almost when you think about Alaska. Is that because of the forestry history or just the...
Yeah, well, I mean, there's relatively few candidates to be the iconic tree. There's, you know, in our study area, there's six species.
Is there a hypothesis about why there's such a limited diversity in
boreal
forests?
Well, there's a few things. You know, I mean, 13,000 years ago, there was essentially zero. Right. So the pollen evidence and the macrofossil evidence suggest that it was essentially a treeless landscape, you know, because the Bering land bridge was exposed. Alaska was cut off from the continental U.S. by gigantic glaciers. You also had these gigantic sand sheets because of the glaciers debauching silt and winds howling around. And so one answer to your question is, you know, these are the species that have gotten back up here since that sort of cataclysm, quote unquote.
So you're still seeing succession almost.
Yes, I think you probably are.
Yeah,
it's a different level of succession. But then there's also just the fact that, you know, as you go towards the poles, diversity in the broad sense declines. So you have fewer species of animals. I mean, diversity is just less at this latitude than it is in the temperate because of the physiological constraints placed by the harsh environment. Low flatlands are occupied in general in permafrost terrain by black spruce forest to woodland, okay? And so it's a very relatively monotonous sort of landscape mosaic. And so when we were designing the study, people are saying, well, you know, you're oversampling black spruce. You know, you're going to get all this stuff and it's all the same. And why would you want to spend all your time, you know, swatting mosquitoes in black spruce woodland? And, you know, I mean, there's a certain validity to that because we're not sampling the real rare types. We are sampling in proportion to how common a type is. But what I think is interesting is that when things may start changing and breaking up, then having sampled the landscape in proportion to, you know, what's out there will yield a bunch more benefits because this black spruce stand might go in this direction, either geographically or ecologically. This one might go in that direction. And then you can kind of understand the basis of that change more than if you were just said, well, I've represented black spruce and we did that over here.
Why do you feel establishing this baseline is an essential thing to do? What's the motivation behind that?
Oh, well, it's strongly motivated by, you know, the desire to conserve and understand these natural landscapes that are in our care. To be able to do that in such a complicated sort of changing world, you need to really understand what's happening and how things are put together. If you trace the National Park Service's history, it came out of a certain context in which resource protection and the rangers were the strongest element of the service, which is good, and also interpretation. But, you know, you need to understand things in order to do resource protection rather than just, not just, but rather than, you know, doing hunting patrols, which are a big part up here to prevent poaching and that sort of thing. And so the INM, the Inventory and Monitoring Program of the National Park Service, is now happening service-wide. You know, in many parks in the lower 48, there's specific issues that are front and center. You know, if you have an endangered species, if you have local influences, whether it be air or water pollution that are degrading the park, you know, you've got your questions for monitoring pretty much forced upon you. That governs a lot of more impacted parks and places that have a lot of exotic species and real threats. I think there's, you know, certainly threats in Alaskan parks, but the scale of them and the immediacy of those threats is different than it is in some parks that are more surrounded by people and stuff. You know, obviously climate change is occurring much more quickly in the polar regions than it is, you know, in the temperate regions. At least that's what the climate data and the modelers are telling us, and it's pretty evident around here with the degradation of permafrost.
Do you feel like you're observing yourself changes in the interior of Alaska that are connected to climate change? Is it something you feel like you're witnessing?
Well, I've been here since 1990. We're doing a project now. It's going to be up on the web soon, a large repeat photography project. You know, the incremental changes probably happen at a rate that is less easy for an individual to see. I mean, there's examples of it, maybe not in our parks as much, but like thermokarst is a process where there's sort of catastrophic melting of an ice lens and sort of collapsing of the landscape. Just as, you know, limestone karst, you get these sinkholes that occur as limestone goes into solution. You get caving in of the landscape. And so that's something, however, that's occurred in cyclical kind of ways over time, ever since the Pleistocene or the Ice Age. But it's happening at a really gargantuan scale in the Arctic parks in Alaska. So you get these huge slumps of mud into rivers. And I have friends who are guides up on the North Slope, and they see just rivers running cloudy from these, I mean, seriously, like multi-parking lot size slumps of bluffs just oozing into a river because it kind of all fails at once. So those are the kinds of things that are pretty, you know, stark. The repeat photography work we've been doing, though, is, you know, better at sort of showing incremental changes such as, you know, transition of vegetation from a more open to a more treed state with tree line, or river bars and floodplains have been heavily colonized by vegetation since a fellow flew around Denali and took pictures in 1976 from the back of a Super Cub airplane and gave me these slides. So we scanned them, digitized them in the GIS as to where they were, and we printed them out, and we got back up in a helicopter, and we kind of flew around and relocated them and took them. And consistent in picture after picture was vegetation closing in on floodplains that were open in 1976. The amazing thing is that in photograph after photograph after photograph, you would expect in a really changeable environment like a river bar that some vegetation would be eroded, you know, some would be established, But really, it's this sort of linear process of closing in. And this is everything from huge rivers, glacial rivers, to small streams. That's the thing about, you know, repeat photography is it's great in terms of this is different than that. The what it's not necessarily so good at is like the why of, you know, the two things being different. One thing I have seen personally is we've had this aspen leaf miner here in the interior for the last three or actually 6 years by now.
And, is that a pest?
Yeah, well, it's probably a native bug, but it turns the aspen all silver, and it's all around Fairbanks. And my understanding, I'm not an entomologist, but that it hasn't been seen 2 years in a row prior to this outbreak, and it's been seen for the last 6 years. We've also had a leaf miner on the willows. You know, our winters haven't been as cold. One of my great worries about the vegetation in Alaska is, you know, insects are so hardwired to temperature. You know, the number of generations, the growth rate, they're very, you know, as you warm things, which they're definitely warming, you're probably going to get more generations per year. You're going to get survivorship over the winter. You're going to get insect herbivory pressure on Alaska plants is going to increase to a level that they're not co-evolved with at this point. So you would expect in that case to, you know, potentially have these large events where, you know, only a few individuals survive because they haven't really been subjected to that kind of pressure. We're starting to see that sort of thing. You know, you do have to be careful about these things because our personal experience is such a small moment, you know, in the geological history of a place that it's tempting to have a paradigm and then of climate change and then fit everything that you see into that in some way. So I try and guard against that, but it's certainly a real thing and we're certainly seeing it.
I think you mentioned that fire dynamics are possibly increasing. Is that something that is just predicted or is that happening now?
We've had some really monster fire years recently. A 2 year stretch in 2004, 2005, that was extraordinary in terms of the acreage and the intensity of fires. I mean, here in Fairbanks, our office, you could walk down the hall and there's no smoking allowed in the office, but it was full of smoke. The thing that people don't realize when they come to Alaska in the interior anyway is that we have 12 inches of rain per year, which is sort of like Phoenix. So it's a semi-arid environment, but because it's frozen 6 months out of the year, you know, the evaporation isn't nearly as much. So if you increase temperature but you don't increase precipitation, you know, you're going to dry the landscape out and the fires that happen are going to get potentially bigger and more intense. A lot of the predictions from warming and from climate change are for dramatic increases in fire. And, you know, there's some very smart people working on this that say in 100 years, the summer of 2004, 2005 might represent a minor fire year. And if that's the case, this place is going to be way, way different. I can't even imagine what that looks like. You know, the thought about the net effect of that kind of change is massive conversion from coniferous forests to broadleaf forests.
So in your introduction, you mentioned that there's roughly four popular hypotheses about how interior forests are going to change with changing climate. Can we talk about that a little bit and,
sure,
and how your paper, what your paper has to say about that?
Yeah, sure.
Conclusion?
Well, you know, one of them is the idea that white spruce, Picea glauca, is very vulnerable to drought stress. The data that support that hypothesis come from a variety of things, mostly tree rings. So there was a science paper, very interesting, that was published a while back. They found that, you know, large white spruce were growing much more slowly in recent decades than they had before. And that's the great thing about tree rings is it expands your monitoring way back in time. So they can look at the decades of since 1900 and look at how spruce has responded. And we take cores at all our sites. But what we found, not from a tree ring aspect yet, although that's underway, is that, you know, white spruce is the most frequently occurring tree in Denali. It occurs in sort of the broadest suite of habitats from, it's the primary tree at treeline. It's co-occurs with black spruce even in some of the lowland wet areas. It's excluded from the seriously permafrost areas due to probably intolerance to having its roots wet and cold soil temperatures. It generally likes to be in warm, less permafrosted terrain. You know, if you look at it by sampling the landscape, it occurs over a very large area and it seems to be regenerating. And so as permafrost thaws, as the landscape dries, that represents a potential large, large area of expansion for the species. It may change in distribution. I think that in its current footprint, it may suffer, but there's going to be opportunities for the species to move into these places that are now too wet for it. It's irrefutable, the tree ring evidence, that it's suffering in current stands, and it's probably particularly bad in that way, sort of in well-established areas. But it's also, again, the primary tree line species, so we see it increasing in abundance and distribution at higher elevations. And probably black spruce is going to be the species that might suffer more because it's relegated, quote-unquote, to sort of the coldest, wettest fraction of the landscape. That's the fraction of the landscape that's in most peril. That was sort of our thinking on that one. Another of the major hypotheses, conversion of primarily coniferous forests to primarily broadleaf forests. Like I said, if that prediction about 2004 and 2005 being a low fire year relative to what it's going to be like in 100 years, then I think that landscape conversion, you know, is absolutely going to happen because I don't see how you prevent it. Broadleaf forests in Alaska tend to be more resistant to fire because they have this shade. And, you know, the conifers kind of are resinous and they want to burn, quote unquote. And even black spruce is semi-serotonous, so it's dependent on fire. What we found in our study area is that there is no evidence at the current time of this conversion of the landscape. There's certainly areas with beautiful, large diameter birch forest. And it's very clear from our models that these species, all the broadleaf species, are directly dependent upon relatively recent disturbance. But, you know, if you look at the percentages of the landscape right now in Denali, it's still greatly dominated by coniferous forests. When you have a state that's so big as Alaska, you know, you just have this tendency to lump things at a larger spatial scale, I think. Yukon Charlie is very different from Denali, which is very different from the western interior, you know, further west, say the Kuskokwim Valley. And so although another thing that we're trying to suggest in the article is that the current landscape is a mosaic and it has different attributes, and it's likely that whatever change happens is going to result in a mosaic as well, not sort of this idea of replacement of conifer to broadleaf. And I think most people in the field fully understand that and accept it, but I think in the public debate and some simplification, it gets, you know, this idea in people's head, like, you know, that they're going to look out the window and it's going to be aspen parkland in 20 years. I just think that's not going to happen.
So you're saying your results suggest that maybe having more hypotheses and pursuing some different ideas would be a good idea.
Exactly. The whole thing has been an interesting process for me because there's a sociological aspect to this, to science, that a lot of scientists who do this work live in Fairbanks, which is a disturbed mosaic, and it's probably got a lot more broadleaf, certainly than Denali Park, because of the long history of people being here and sort of the steamships that came through and the increased fire return and all this kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, it's easy to be influenced by your immediate surroundings when you think about things. I do think it's really important to have this sort of multiple working hypotheses, because basically you can't answer the questions you don't ask. Like, well, is white spruce going to move into newly thawed areas? Some folks might say with the increased drying, it's still going to be physiologically outside its capability to survive in the climate. And that's been argued in some recent papers. There's a paper suggesting the biome shift in Alaska has basically already begun. People make good points about that. You know, so those are two of them. And then another one has to do with insects. Another thing we show in our paper is that 60% of the larch individuals in our plots, that's Larix laricina, are dead. That's a fairly minor component of the forest, and it tends to occur in bogs. And so people, it's a wonderful tree. It's beautiful. You know, it's not economically important. If that kind of mortality had happened to white spruce, you would probably be hearing nothing but in terms of forests in Alaska. The other fourth hypothesis that we talked about was the expansion of tree line.
Tree line moving outward into the tundra?
So trees expanding into tundra both elevationally and at the latitudinal tree line. So, you know, out on the Seward Peninsula where, you're basically in the tundra biome, you're seeing white spruce move out there. And in Denali Park, many of our repeat photos show increase in density and sort of moving up in elevation of spruce. You know, it's a complicated thing, but we basically would predict sort of river terrace environments, south exposed terrain, that sort of area, white spruce is currently expanding, and if it warms, would continue to expand. I'm very sort of hesitant to prognosticate about the future. I just don't feel confident in knowing what's going to happen. But, you know, there are conclusions that follow from our results that we put out there more or less as kind of suggesting that multiple working hypotheses about landscape change in Alaska would be a good thing. A consensus has been developing around this idea of conversion to broadleaf and even grasslands, as we say in our abstract, you know, because that's what lies on the other side of the warm and dry spectrum from broadleaf forests is. So if you go further east into the Yukon Territory, say Whitehorse, that area, you start to get grassy aspen parkland kinds of environments like you really see, say, in Alberta and some of those places. And so, you know, one thing that we do as humans is we take exemplars of, you know, we fit paradigms of what we see currently, and we use those as some kind of representations of what it might be in the future. The thing that I find difficult in thinking about change is, you know, what novel combinations of species and the environments are we going to have, because the dimensions of change are not really fully knowable. And there's certainly modeling, but what's not really known so well is precipitation. If you get increased warming, but a lot of increased precipitation, you're going to get a very different environment than if you get the same precipitation. It's all about the details of how change happens, I think, in terms of what you get.
How long are you going to be monitoring? Is this an ongoing?
This is, as permanent as things get. As they say, it's, you know, these are permanent vegetation plots we're putting in. The longer you're around, the more you wonder what permanence is in our jobs. But it's basically, you know, it's a 10-year remeasurement cycle in Denali. That's the plan. And that's obviously pending the ability to maintain funding and maintain. So it's also incumbent on having skillful, interested, and passionate people with that natural history. We do everything from vascular plants to all the lichens to all the mosses. We collected in the first round of sampling that culminated in this paper 20,000 separate specimens of plants that all required, you know, identification and cataloging and all that. I mean, we didn't keep all of them. So, you know, so this is sort of a plug for, you know, undergraduates and graduates being trained in field biology, because that's really what runs our show.
Do you have much coordination with the academic sphere, with the University of Alaska and Fairbanks? How much do you work with them?
Well, it's something I'd like to have more of. There's a natural division of labor between folks in agencies such as myself and people in the academic world. We have these large, relatively intact landscapes with a mandate to care for them and monitor them. And, you know, the ability to logistically do these things and hire field biologists and do things, more importantly, over a long term. Whereas, you know, your normal academic grant, you know, how long does it go for? Maybe 2 or 3 years. And one value that we have is this sort of long-term mandate to do this. And that's hard for academic scientists. And so I've always wanted to sort of stimulate greater cooperation, because they've got, you know, certainly the brain power and the technology and things to do things that we don't necessarily have the mandate or ability to do. But we have this other ability to, you know, keep things going and collect this baseline of data that might, you know, allow for a larger context. And so, I mean, I came up through graduate school working on various park projects. I have a person who's finishing a PhD at Corvallis at OSU, working on the lichen in the caribou habitat. Another woman who works for me is starting a PhD here at UAF looking at tree rings. And so that sort of interplay is, you know, happening in fits and starts and starting to happen. But my vision sort of all along was to get this baseline of data and then try and establish more of these connections once the value of what we're doing is more clear to folks in academia. Because there's also sort of a, you know, I guess, status element to working in an agency versus working in an academia. You don't always have the credentials as perceived. And so I think publishing, you know, having this focus that we do of publishing in the peer-reviewed literature is one way of acquiring that sort of level of credential to get people more interested in what we're doing. I mean, it's obviously important on its own to publish things, to get things out there, because, you know, having worked my entire career one way or another in the Park Service, there's so much even really good work that goes into the gray literature and disappears forever, in my estimation. It's kind of, you know, you do these reports, and then 10 years later, someone comes in fresh-faced and all full of vigor and says, oh, we need to do this. And, you know, if you've been around long enough, you said, well, you know, that was done 10 years ago. But unfortunately, there's a tendency for gray literature to sort of go by the wayside eventually. So that's another reason that we try and take that extra effort to, you know, publish papers that go into databases and the academic circulation.
That's just a little more accessible.
Yeah, more accessible and more, you know, I think, durable.
Do you think, I've noticed that the government seems to have more of a mandate to get more of that information posted on the web, make it available to the public. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, I think that's a natural outgrowth of starting to acquire much more data, certainly in the Park Service with the professionalization of science and this INM mandate. What's been really good about the development of some of that is just the emphasis on data management, which is a new thing. For this project, we developed a really strong database structure at the start. I was very worried about it actually at the start because, you know, I was so used to paper data sheets and, you know, unless you lose them or you do something boneheaded, but really, you know, knock on wood, the whole field computing aspect has been a real boon to efficient. And, you know, I used to have people entering data until December from this project. And they would end up hating you because 8 hours of entering data, you know, at least I hope. hopefully it wasn't me personally that they hated, but, you know. So I think that with that emphasis on data management at the agency level, that the sharing of it becomes much easier. And so, you know, for these data, we put in the, it's called Dryad, which is a, you know, ecological archive. And I think, you know, that has to happen. You know, that sharing of data, we didn't do all this work to just keep it to ourselves.
All right. Well, Carl, thanks for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun. Take care.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.